You're giving a major address tonight at New York University, the King Juan Carlos Center, on Puerto Rican debt crisis.
Yes, I decided after writing numerous columns in the Daily News and talking here about it that I've never been able to do a full explanation of what is happening with the debt crisis and what are the potential solutions for what can the United States do to help Puerto Rico in the current crisis. So I'm hoping to do that tonight at NYU.
So that's at the Juan Carlos Center at New York University tonight at 7 p.m. There'll be a live stream as well, and we will link to it at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is hiring a director of development to lead our fundraising efforts. You can send in your resume. You can get more information at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez.
The time is 8 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned. Coming up, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. Paul Rowland's guest is Jacqueline Keeler. The topic is the racist appropriation of Native culture and a national debate on cultural appropriation.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Health Club's Body Positive Block Party, Thursday, October 22nd at Health Club in Portland. The Body Positive Block Party is an inaugural bash for Portland's first body positive, worker-owned, community-centered barbell gym. Again, that's the Body Positive Block Party on Thursday, October 22nd, 7 p.m. at Health Club, 1235 Southeast Division Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Jacko as part of the We Real Cool KBOO at the Clinton Jazz Film Series on Thursday, October 22nd at 7 p.m. Jacko tells the story of Jaco Pastorius, a self-taught, larger-than-life musician who changed the course of modern music. Never-before-seen archival footage unveils the story of Jaco's life, his music, his demise, and the lasting victory of artistic genius. Again, that's Jacko, Thursday, October 22nd, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information about films and screening times can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories with a focus on natural fibers. Since 1984, Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com.
It is what it is. So no use in wishing, hoping, and wanting. And those if only and those coulda, shoulda, and wouldas are just troubles for the head. And crying around about most anything is just a waste of tears.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. Life doesn't put anything in front of us that we can't handle. It's all in the handling. Coherent or incoherent. Clarity or chaos. Another thing, everything that ever happens is there to make us stronger. And when we understand, our strength gets stronger. And when we don't understand, our weaknesses get stronger.
And good morning. Welcome to the airwaves, or if you've been listening, glad you're still with us. This is KBOO Community Radio. This is Wednesday morning talk radio. My name is Paul Rowland. I'll be with you until 9 o'clock. And that was John Trudell opening up It Is What It Is from his Crazier Than Hell CD. He was in town at Hempstock on Saturday. Gave a stripped down, really amazing, ethereal performance. And I have live in the studio Jacqueline Keeler. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning.
We're going to talk about a bunch of different things. We're going to be talking about fake Indians. We're going to be talking about Halloween costumes, masketry, the new University of Oregon Pioneer uniforms, and lots of other stuff. And Jacqueline lives in Portland, and she's of Yankton and Dene heritage, hails from Cleveland, Ohio, and is involved in this eradicating offensive Native masketry and this really widening movement against cultural appropriation. Is that one way of putting it?
Yeah, we call it misappropriation.
Misappropriation.
Yeah.
Because I guess there are forms of, obviously there are forms of cultural appropriation that are appropriate.
I don't know. It's a pretty touchy subject. So, okay. But yeah, definitely we see a lot of misappropriation, and the issue often in the way our culture is used is without regard to our feelings about it, or, you know, we don't have much input into it. And that's really the test to see if it's appropriate or not.
So one thing that you've been getting into a lot in your writings that I've been following is your alma mater has kind of exploded into the news.
Yeah. I went to Dartmouth College, and as some of you may know, Dartmouth has was originally founded as an Indian school, and the money to start it was originally raised by a Mohican Indian man, and he raised 10,000 pounds of silver back in the 1760s, and which was about the equivalent to $130 million today in building funds, and to start a college for his people. But then his mentor, Eliezer Wheelock, went and moved the college up to New Hampshire, far away from the Mohican people of Connecticut. and it was quite a sad day for Sansom Ockham, who swore he would never visit the campus. Although if you go to campus, there's a lot of things named after him there. And so 200 years go by, and Wheelock didn't fulfill the promise to educate Indian youth. The charter from King George III says that the college is supposed to educate Indian youth and others. And so for 200 years, they focused on the others. And then in the 1960s, the president of the college decided to reaffirm that commitment.
Was that on his or her own, or was there some
President Kemeny was a he's the one who invented the basic computer language. Uh-huh. And so he was a very sort of detail oriented person, and when he read the charter, he read it literally, and he was like, why aren't we doing this? He was an immigrant, and he from Europe, and he just was like, why aren't we doing this? And so he just immediately began set about recommitting the college to that, and began bringing in Native students from all over the country. And now Dartmouth has the largest Native alumni group of all the Ivies. Pretty much our alumni group is larger than all the rest of them combined. And we have a very large Native American program. And so there was a big concern when they hired a Native American program director, and this is not an academic position, this is a counseling position where they counsel Native students, keep them, make sure they don't leave camp, they stay and graduate, so it's very much a hand-holding position, where they really need to be able to relate to the students. And this person who had applied for the job had no Indian aunts. She had pretended to be Indian to get the job. And it's a little more complicated than that. But so a blog called Fake Indians, which is run by Native people who are some of them are professional genealogists and tribal genealogists, and they looked into her background, and Inside Higher Ed then covered the fact that she had no Indian ancestry, that it was completely fraudulent. And so obviously someone like that cannot counsel Native youth. Particularly Native youth are struggling in a New England, isolated, extremely privileged environment. And then also the Delaware tribe, her family claimed to be this lost group of Delaware that hid out for 200 years pretending to be white and had all their records changed and all this stuff. The Delaware tribes in Oklahoma were extremely offended. And because their people suffered greatly, they had to leave, and they didn't leave anyone behind. And this notion that there are these hidden Indians all over the place, hiding out as white people for hundreds of years, is pretty pernicious. So they were very insulted, and it kind of caused an international incident between these sovereign nations in Oklahoma and the college.
There's a lot of different aspects to this. One of which, obviously, it must be extremely sensitive issue to, you know, Native people who want to enter into roles like that, into academia, into, you know, important positions of, you know, responsibility, and, you know, paid positions are always good to get. And when you have someone who's actually, you know, according to all accounts, either intentionally or unintentionally because of what was passed down from her family, that's an open question, I guess, to some extent, but now it seems like it's out in the open. But so that question is, you know, it must be a very sensitive issue in Indian country.
Well, it is. I mean, when the whole Rachel Dolezal thing came out,
And who is she?
Oh, she is the Spokane NAACP director who was found to be pretending to be black, and or she called it transracial. And she also had a story that she was raised in a teepee and was part Indian as uh-huh. well. And she grew up shooting bow and arrows. So she kind of covered the whole gamut. And it was very unusual because, of course, you know, that doesn't really happen very often. But a lot, this happens all the time, people pretending to be Native. And, you'll see a lot of the, and this brought out another academic at UC Riverside, like Andrea Smith, who many Cherokee have confronted about the fact that she has no documented Cherokee ancestry. And yet, in academic circles, these people become the favorites. And it almost feels like white people pretending to be Indians are better at it, are more appealing to other white people than actual Indians, because I think they know how to play it in a way that is more interesting and appeals more to the desires and wishes of what an Indian should be. And I find that very interesting. And talking to my friends who are in academia, it's very frustrating. That these people are given preferential treatment to actual Native people and actual Native experiences. And in the case of the Dartmouth Dolezal, as she got to be called, her grandfather in the 1980s started his own tribe, and it was very much a sort of situation where it did get into some sort of sticky areas. They were doing sex magic Lenape adoption ceremonies and sweat lodges, him and his friends.
I think I saw some references to that.
Yeah, and then one of their tribal members, their head of their medicine society and a sub-chief, ended up going to prison for molesting, for rape and stuff in these ceremonies. And so it's sort of sometimes giving yourself an Indian identity seems to give people certain advantages, as far as being able to take advantage of other people, to, you know, be able to explore sexual things they want to do. You know, I was interviewing Dr. Nikki Michael, who she's a tribal councilwoman from the Delaware Tribe of Indians in Oklahoma, and she was saying it leads to sort of a bastardization of their culture. You know, when people are making up these traditions, selling them, and they're able to successfully sell them in Pennsylvania because, of course, all the Indians were removed. And so there's this great hunger in Pennsylvania, from even like the University of Pennsylvania, to learn more about Indians. And so when these groups popped up 30 years ago, they began to say, wow, maybe there's some truth to it. But with this Dartmouth Dalzell, her family lineage is clearly, all of her great grandparents are from Ireland. I mean, it's not even like they weren't marking white. They were marking their villages in Ireland they were from. And the paperwork goes all the way back to these villages. So unless they were able to successfully in the 19th century fraudulently present themselves as being from specific villages in Ireland, I don't think they were hiding out. And her family didn't even arrive until 100 years after the Delaware were removed. And it's just a story they made up, and they were able to get enough people to buy into it.
Well, you know, there's a couple of directions I wanted to go in, but, you know, it kind of goes back to, you know, there's these, you know, there's like the whole thing around, like, in some, like, Boy Scout kind of culture, and, you know, like, camp, get you gumi or whatever, you know, there's this whole, and early on, there was, you must have read about this, like, going back into the 19th century, I don't know if earlier, there's like these, you know, these clubs, these men's clubs or whatever that took on societies, fraternal societies, sort of took on the costumery of Native Americans, yeah, and sort of the names and stuff.
Well, that's, you know, it's so funny. One of my distant cousins, he wrote a book called Playing Indian. His name is Philip Deloria, and and it documents. It's a very thorough documentation of America's history of playing Indian going back to the colonial era, and it's interesting too because. You know, my mom, in my mom's culture, my mother's Navajo, and my father is Yankton, Dakota. There is this tradition in the Navajo culture of skinwalkers. I don't know if you've heard of that before. But they basically are witches, male witches mostly, and who don the skins of other animals, and then they can be those animals, you know, at night. And they have, like, these superpowers. And they tell, like, sort of a lot of... scary stories about them in Navajo. And it sort of reminds me of that, where they take on, you know, they've killed us all off, and now they're going to wear our skins, wear our culture, wear our identity, and replace us. And it's something quite horrible about that, I think. And it's very pernicious. I mean, it's astounding at how many people are doing this. I mean, the Cherokee Nation, you know, documented over 212 different groups of fake tribes who are pretending to be Cherokee, you know. And these tribes get 501c3, you know, they incorporate, they're very active. And yet it's all just, I mean, it's sort of like game playing, you know. They're taking on these identities and they're enjoying it, but they don't realize the cost. I think that Native people are trying to retain their culture, trying to retain their political existence. That's the other thing, is they go from this sort of desire to be these sort of hobbyist organizations to actually wanting the political privileges that sovereign nations enjoy. And so that's where it becomes quite, gets into kind of strange territory.
I want to tie this into the, you know, the timely subject that we also wanted to touch on, which is Halloween. You know, you mentioned there's something horrible about that, and the skinwalker sort of harks to this, you know, the Halloween tradition in a kind of way. The underside of this, the reality of this, and the real history of, you know, of the subjugation and treatment of indigenous people in North America and around the world is sort of covered up by this sort of this light superficial treatment of the donning of feathers and stuff. And then, you know, when confronted, because that's something you've been writing about, and it's something that's, you know, with the internet has sort of spread virally, this sort of calling out of, like, models who don the headdress, or, you know, rock stars or their girlfriends or whatever, you know, on stage, or people at rock concerts or fashion magazines, or, you know, across the board. And when confronted, they're like, oh, you know, oh, it's just, you know, it's not serious. It's like, lighten up, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, the issue is people know so little about us. I mean, my dad's culture is the culture that is generally appropriated for that purpose. I mean, the Plains Indian, you know, Dakota, Lakota culture is constantly used that way. And those headdresses I don't want to use the word sacred, but they represent, they have a lot of cultural weight and
power.
Yeah. I mean, they represent something specific within our culture. And, those feathers represent, people often say, well, they're about, how many kills he made and stuff. But really, no, it's really about every one of those feathers represent the, like a vote or the belief or the trust or the hopes of the people in their leader. And then the obligations that leader has to the people. And so it has a very different meaning than, say, how a Victoria's Secret model would wear it on the runway to look, or a girl wearing it at a musical festival. You know, it's not about being sexy. It has real meaning from a culture that really had figured out how to create leaders that were accountable to their people. I think that is what is lost in all this is they don't know a lot about our actual culture. I mean, I think I was telling you earlier about how Lakota culture and Dakota culture, they were able to create a culture whereby leaders were people who were willing to give away everything for their people. You know, we had these things called giveaways, much like potlatches here in the Pacific Northwest. And the idea was that a real leader, a real person, a real human being could give away everything they own without holding, there's that catch in your breath that you have when you're afraid. You know, a real human being is someone who trusts their community. It's like a trust fall. You fall back and you know your community is going to catch you. And so there are all these stories in my family about they do these giveaways and to show just how much they believed in the community, they would give away everything they owned, even their teepee. And by nightfall, it would all be returned to them. Other tribe members would give back. And there was this idea that this was the strength of the community. And there wasn't this notion that one family had to hoard all the money to themselves or, you don't get this sort of sociopathic leadership like you see in Wall Street. And so I think that was something that the Lakota people and that headdress represents is that sort of person. And so we had a very different kind of leadership in our traditional cultures. And it's something that I think so human social knowledge engineering is very precious. And certainly the interaction between the colonists and indigenous people of the Americas has led to a lot of new social concepts like democracy. Definitely meeting the Iroquois Confederacy informed the colonists on how they were going to create their government. Seeing Iroquois women, have the rights and the power to reorganize their government, led Elizabeth Cady Stanton to call for, modern kind of women's rights. And so, the interaction between our social systems and European social systems is what has created the modern world. And so I think that is all lost when all you're doing is, just taking the very surface elements and not at all acknowledging or understanding where they come from.
I want to pursue that whole idea of the giveaway and get into some of these other things we want to talk about. But I want to remind people, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm Paul Rowland, the host, and I'm speaking with Jacqueline Keeler, who's a writer and an activist who lives here in Portland. She's from Cleveland. She's of Diné or Navajo and Yankton ancestry, Yankton Sioux ancestry. And
I was born in Cleveland, but I moved away when I was still a preschooler, so.
Forgot that part of it.
Yeah, my parents met in Cleveland through the Relocation Act.
Right.
And there was an act in the 50s and 60s to terminate tribes and relocate the young people to urban centers, and Cleveland was one of those places.
And so where did you move to right after that?
We moved to Denver. And then we moved out here to Washington State.
You had told me that, but I...
Yeah, I
got this Cleveland fixed because...
Yes, because of all the writing I've done about the Cleveland Indians. Yeah, when I went back in April, to protest at the Major League Baseball opener. I got to reconnect with the Cleveland Indian community, and it's still there. You know, the real Cleveland Indians,
right.
The American Indians, and there when my family lived there, there was probably about 20,000 young Native people there. I think now it's a little less, but I went back, and it was like going home. They were so happy to see me. It was just really wonderful. I mean, it's still a really wonderful Native community there, and urban. I mean, there are so many wonderful urban Native communities, and we're lucky to have a really great one here in Portland too.
So I want to invite people to call in. After all, this is a call-in show, and the number is 503-231-8187 if you have any questions, comments about what we're talking about this morning. So let's go right to our first caller, James.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, no, this is a great subject. I get into, I talk to people about this sort of stuff constantly about there was a question posed on my face. Somebody posed a question about like, well, what's the difference between borrowing and appropriation? And my response is that, borrowing, it's like appropriation is just forgetting whose house you're in. You know, and that's really what it comes down to. It's like, if you're gonna use Native American headdress, then you should probably do some research on what it means. I know a lot of people who really just don't care about that, and I used to find it frustrating, but now it's just like, I just don't even deal with those people anymore. But it's like you can't use something that doesn't belong to you just for whatever you think you should use it for. And because like you said, it bastardizes the traditions, and it's really funny to me how it's like people can just, or how like everybody thinks that, oh, every Native American tribe smudges, and it's like you would know that that's not true if you actually did just a little bit of research. But it's like everybody's just kind of happy with the one size fits all sort of thing. So.
So
go ahead.
Would you like Jackie to comment on that, or?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Hi, James. I totally agree. I mean, I actually am. I'm lucky to be a member of two different tribes, very different culturally different tribes, being Navajo from the Southwest, where my grandmother wove rugs, and my mom's family raised sheep and ranched, and it's a totally different culture than in the plains where my father's people, I'm actually related to Sitting Bull. It's sort of like it's that, this, I don't want to say stereotypical, which I guess it is, in idea of Indian culture. I get so much from knowing those cultures, knowing the details, having my life enriched by them. That's what I write about a lot. Last year there was a Navajo boy in Florida who was sent home because his hair was too long and they wanted him to cut it. And I wrote about that because my son had long hair and no one had ever bothered him about it. And my grandfather was a traditional Navajo man, and of course wore his hair in a bun, a silieth, and so, because Navajos wear their hairs in buns, not braids, and so I wrote about that, about what hair we wash our hair with yucca root. When I was married in a traditional Navajo ceremony, they washed my hair in yucca root, and they bathed and dried my jewelry with, fed my turquoise jewelry with corn meal. And there's all these elements to the culture which are really precious to me, and I can't imagine having lived without them. I mean, I couldn't imagine not having all that, and my father's culture is equally as rich, and yet here in America we are surrounded by hundreds of these cultures all around us. And this is a privilege. These are stories, experiences that every American should have the privilege of knowing about in greater depth. And they should be told. There should be TV shows featuring, Native families, modern Native American families. And, it should be just a part of our culture. And as you can see from past interactions, the world benefited. I mean, you know, billions of women have better lives today because, you know, what white women in New York State learned from watching Iroquois women, you know, and yeah. So it can have a huge impact.
Yeah, and just one more thing I wanted to comment on, you know, it's the fact is, you know, I've met a lot of folks who oppose is to be Native American and really not, and, you know, you talked about how, you know, the folks who are white who pretend to be Native American seem to get favored. And I think maybe you already know this, but, you know, but I think the reason why that they are favored is because they don't have to confront the wrongs. You know, they don't have to confront the, they don't, if you're putting a white face on a Native American tradition, then you really don't have to confront the wrongs that have been perpetrated because, you know, most white folks don't even really know the extent of the genocides or the things that Native Americans were forced to go through. I mean, most of us know are just from terrible Westerns that have been made that have, you know, had Native American folks in it. But, you know, the victors will always put them forth as savages who were, you know, who just mercilessly killing women and children when it's, you know, they were defending their nations. And, you know, but you don't have to confront those sort of things if you put a white face on it.
That's a very good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling, James.
So thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Keep it up.
All right. Bye. And so let's, we had another caller, but let's just really quickly get into a couple of these things we wanted to mentioned some really recent stuff. We talked, you know, Halloween's coming up. We've sort of touched on that. But specifically, are there some flags, red flags, that have been thrown up recently that have come to your attention in the lead up to Halloween here?
Wow. Well, there's been some good things that have happened. I wrote about Columbus Day last year, or called Goodbye Columbus, and I was thinking, wow, like so much has happened in the past year. I mean, we have so many cities and states even that have just decided to go with Indigenous Peoples Day. I think there's been
Including Portland, and I
think that it's wonderful, and I think that I would have to totally rewrite that. Well, I probably don't have to totally rewrite it, but I think that there's been so much progress made, and I was really excited to see that an elementary school in Berkeley is actually, you know, has asked parents not to wear ethnically, specific costumes.
Because obviously it doesn't only pertain to Native Americans, because there's obviously blackface and there's all kinds of strange.
Yeah, but there are still people. I mean, I think that, who was it? I think there was an African-American music artist who went to a Halloween party the other night dressed as a cowboy, and his girlfriend was dressed as a sexy squaw outfit, you know, and so to see that kind of like Farrell was on the cover of Elle magazine wearing a headdress, and to see African Americans being that insensitive is sort of, I mean, they're just people, but I mean, it's still disappointing, you know. And of course, you see some Native Americans, you know. I don't know. I think appropriation needs to be more clearly understood still, and marginalized. Yeah, I think that's been our goal with the mascot issue, is to marginalize the behavior. We've asked. We would like, you know, like the city of Portland to not allow performers on their to wear red face when they're on stage. That's what we call it, you know, the wearing of the our regalia, and then also because we protested the Flaming Lips when they were here because the lead singer likes to put on, you know, our regalia, and then also we protested what's his name. That crazy guy.
Ted Nugent,
yeah, who was playing, at another city-owned venue. And you know, he claims he actually has an eagle feather headdress, which is totally illegal, by the way. It's against federal law to possess eagle feathers. It's a huge fine and prison time if you have them, if you are not a member of a federally recognized tribe and have a permit for it. You cannot have eagle feathers.
So what would your admonition then to our listeners be to be very vigilant and to, you know, gently or perhaps not so gently remind people who are, you know, abusing Native or other cultures or other racial groups, ethnic groups to, you know, say something?
Yeah, gosh, you know, I think it is really hard to go up and say something to someone. I think that's why I do a lot of my activism, you know, through writing and we do a lot of memes and we reach out to people who are, you know, doing that, especially actors. And but yeah, I think just saying, look, you know, that's not how we want our culture to be used, you know, and what kind of, I think that for Americans, this is a really great time to reconsider what kind of relationship do we want to have with Indigenous people and particularly with, you know, citizens of sovereign nations that have persisted and survived, you know, U.S. Incursions on their land. I mean, I think the Yakama Nation just got back a lot of their jurisdiction, you know, criminal enforcement jurisdiction over the lands. I think that what we're going to be seeing in the 21st century is more and more consolidation of Native sovereignty, the reemergence of what we call tribes as actual sovereign states within the larger world. You know, if you look at I'm a citizen of the Navajo Nation, and we have a population of 340,000 members, and the tribe estimates that another 200,000 could enroll but haven't. So we're talking about 500,000 Navajos. You know, we have a reservation. Our nation is the size of Ireland. You know, we have the we're larger than 22 member states of the UN. You know, so we are the size of a nation. I mean, we are within the United States. Our sovereignty is limited by what the U.S. will allow us to exercise. You know, and that's what people need to realize is that we haven't gone away. We were sovereign nations when those, you know, European settlers landed. Those settlers isn't the right word, is it? You know, invaders landed and tried to claim we were. You mentioned the doctrine of discovery earlier when we were talking, and that is basically a papal ruling by the Pope, you know, issued shortly before, you know, the explorers came here, and in the 15th century, and basically saying that any discovered peoples did not possess actual legal title to their land. That only the discovering Christian nation had legal title to the land. And this is a basic human right that all human beings in the world possess, which is legal title to their land. What they basically, and the U.S. Government still cites the papal bull as the underpinning of their legal right to the land of the United States itself, which most Americans
kind
do
of a
not
shocking
know.
Thing,
yeah.
Man.
And so,
as recently as the 2000s, I think. Right?
Yes, yeah. Yes. If you look under constitutional law, you know, it's very clear. But we want the rights that all human beings have. We are not basically what it says in the Supreme Court ruling was that that we have this, that Indians are like the wild animals. We only have the use of the land, not the ownership of the land. And, you know, this fee simple title is basic. It's a basic human right of all, you know, human beings. And we want that right. And we have that right. We are asserting it. And by retaining our political existence, we defy that papal bull. We defy genocide. And so that's something that Americans need to get their minds around and realize they live in an archipelago of Indigenous nations that have survived and will continue to grow into the 21st century.
Well, let's go to another caller. Brian, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, hi, it's Brian. How are you?
Good, go ahead.
Oh, good. So, listen, I lived out in Albuquerque, Santa Fe area for about 8 years. And, you know, the trade and commerce is incredible. And, you know, if you go up to the market square in Santa Fe, you know, you see incredible prices. You see people from Germany and Europe buying, you know, art of the Zuni and the tribes around that area. For just enormous prices, you know, a lot of it is, and it's all sold by white people, and you know, none of those shops are owned by Indigenous people, And people are discouraged. The tourists are discouraged from buying, you know, from Indian or Native American vendors. And it's really sad. And I'll tell you, I living there for so long and knowing, you know, the Native Americans in that area, there's 19 tribes. And it's really nothing to meet some person who weaves rugs or makes jewelry, and their stuff is in the Smithsonian, and they're living in a house without electricity or water, which is pretty common on the Navajo Reservation. And, you know, they're living basically in subsistence, and their rugs or their jewelry are in some museum, you know,
yeah.
somewhere.
Yeah,
and they're being sold for, you know, enormous amounts of money, where that person is selling their stuff for almost nothing.
Yeah, I used to live in Albuquerque, and I worked as a community organizer. I got to work with several of the Rio Grande Pueblos, and I got to work out in Zuni Yakima and also on Hopi and Eastern Navajo. And I think that I really miss it. I mean, I think I miss being in a community where there are so many Native people, and I really loved the exposure to all the different Pueblo cultures. Which are very different than Navajo culture. I mean, it's I as a community organizer, my job was to actually go into the communities and help the community members to organize around issues that they wanted addressed.
Absolutely.
And so
I'd like to make just one more comment. When I was in Albuquerque, I just listened to KUNM, which is the public radio, but there was a Native America Calling, which was part of a larger network you might be able to.
Yeah, I've been on that show a few times. It's a national call-in show about Native issues. It's really really wonderful.
Yeah, and if people want to know about Native issues, and I think time has come where we need to put that, you know, right up front. No matter if we have a large Native American community or not. You know, we need to all be aware of this, the travesties just constant, and they're still going on.
Yeah, I think I think the Southwest is such a great place to see all this happening. I got to work with a Navajo community, and I got to push a bill in Santa Fe at the state legislature to bring electricity to their community. It was a really rewarding experience, and I know that there is still so much to be done, I love the art in Santa Fe, and I love Native artists, and there are some different things you can go to there that where you can deal directly with the Native artists, like the Southwest Indian Market, and also the new one, Indigenous Fine Arts Market, and with those you're dealing directly with the Native artists, and a lot of them are online now and selling directly from their own storefronts. So I think with the advent of selling through the internet, that they are gaining a lot more of a personal audience.
Well, it's great you're here in Portland. You take care.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks for calling, Brian. And again, this is a Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Roland, and I'm speaking with Jacqueline Keeler about a wide range of issues, mainly focusing on cultural misappropriation of indigenous culture and misrepresentation. And I just realized I neglected to mention at the outset that Jacqueline is also going to be on a panel tomorrow evening on challenging so-called liquefied natural gas, which is actually a fracked gas from the interior west, which they want to pipe across several states and to the Oregon coast and ship to the Asian markets. Anyway, LNG it's called. And it's going to be at the First Unitarian Church in Southwest Portland. I believe that's on Southwest 12th or in Salmon around there. Anyway, they've got a Facebook page. And so tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm going to be on the panel tomorrow. And let's see here.
I think it starts at 7.
Yeah, I'm going to. So, and one of the other speakers is Dan Saris of Columbia Riverkeeper, and he will actually be providing testimony from Umatilla elders, Carl Sampson and Kathy Sampson Cruz as well. And, I think that the issue of sovereignty and the issue of fossil fuels and their transportation has really impacted the tribes and maybe started to create more mature relationships with the surrounding states. I think that if you look at these projects, they inordinately impact indigenous lands and resources, and so tribes have been a very strong voice, a moderating voice in how these projects proceed.
Yeah, whether it's the KXL pipeline cutting across several tribal territories in the Dakotas, or the horrible coal trains coming through here and coming from Crow territory. But I was thinking of the not the tar sands, but the fracked oil in North Dakota, which is just a horror scene. If you look at the photos of the flared gas at night, it's as bright as any city, just about. Anyway,
it's terrible. Yeah, I got to interview a lot of the community members there. I've been doing a lot of writing on these issues. My dad's family are very involved with the Keystone XL fight. My mom has family in Arizona, has to deal with uranium mining on their land, and there's still a lot of open uranium mines there. So yeah, in the environment, we live on the land, we care about it, and so we are often having to fight these really harmful extraction projects.
And that'll be tomorrow evening at the First Unitarian Church, Southwest 12th and Salmon, and that will start at 7 p.m. And you can hear and meet Jackie and a number of other excellent speakers on challenging liquefied natural gas terminals in Oregon. Let's go to, we got a couple more callers. Mike of Washington County, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
I was listening, I turned on the radio when there was the caller before left was speaking about borrowing versus appropriation. And this is a really KBOO provides this wonderful service by allowing these difficult conversations, and this topic is very important to me. It's a global issue about basically it's about Native American culture and its clashes with the dominant white culture, but that applies to every, not just Native American, applies to, globally, like I said. Myself, I am white. I grew up Jewish on the East Coast. I moved west. I lived in the Southwest, and kind of got adopted by couple Native American people. I spent time on pueblos and for a couple years, and eventually I moved out here, and I've got my own family. I think I represent a lot of white people who basically have kind of shed their identity as where they came from, and are part of and want respect. And I think that what it comes down to is appreciation and respect for different cultures, whichever culture. If I'm in company of Native Americans, then respect for their culture versus abuse.
Yeah, I think that one of the interesting things is, I think that one of the issues that makes that exacerbates this problem is the issue of the the overt attempt of the U.S. government to make our cultures and our political entities to disappear. I often feel like what has been under attack is our inherent claims to the land, which are preserved within the political context. And so the attacks on our culture and our attempts to preserve it are directly tied to the threat we pose to the U.S. government's claims to our territory. And I think that only by strengthening our political status can we have the wherewithal to really maintain those boundaries, those cultural boundaries. I think that an example would be a very strong national identity would be like being French or German, and it's very hard to appropriate those. You know, you could be an Anglophile or a Francophile, but you can't really, you know, appropriate the culture to the extent that that people attempt to do with our culture. And I think that a stronger, having a much more firm identity, our identity has been basically under assault for 200 years, it would help that a great deal. And I also think that one of the reasons why people are trying to pretend to be us, you know, sort of an extreme version of Anglophilia or something, could be the fact that there is not the option of being naturalized. And if we were able to fully exercise our sovereignty, we could naturalize people. And certainly the Cherokee Nation fought for that right all the way to the Supreme Court in the 1830s. But of course, the U.S. found that extremely intimidating, the idea that white immigrants could vote with their feet whether they wanted to be a citizen of the Cherokee Nation versus under the authority of the state of Georgia was extremely intimidating. And so the U.S. policy has always been to minimize our presence, minimize our political reality, so that they can have access, full and unencumbered access to our territory.
Okay.
Hello?
Yeah, did you have something else to say?
Yeah. Well, I think that's two different issues. One is representation, legal representation, and the government. And I mean, I don't understand.
I think they are connected. I think they are connected to each other. The reason why it's so difficult for Native Americans to protect their identity is directly tied to the assault on our identity, which is then tied to our political identity.
What I'm saying is that the assault on the identity is a lot more complicated because there's people that I'll talk about black culture, like hip hop, and they talk about being appropriated as well by whites. But I mean, there's a lot of amazing. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to want to adopt Native American culture. If you're from white culture, I mean, there's a lot to be ashamed of if you have a white heritage. And then the thing with government is complete. I mean, we took your land. I mean, it's ridiculous that the history of what I mean. I read, just read people's history of the United States, and that tells it pretty well. And there's no reason why you shouldn't have representation, to be able to sit at the table of government when you're talking about your national land.
Yeah, I'm just saying that if our national identities, there are 566 federally recognized tribes in the United States right now, if those boundaries were more firmly in place, it would be much more difficult for people to assume our identities, and it wouldn't end and our culture. And I think the fact that there is not, these boundaries are not strong, is a fundamental factor in why it's so threatening when they do. And you could put on a beret and carry a loaf of baguette around and try to pretend to be French, but that would not in any way have the same meaning or carry the same weight of appropriation as doing something similar with regalia. And the reason has to do with the strength.
Because as long as it's going to be. So I really appreciate the time. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling. We only have about 5 minutes left. And so a bunch of things we wanted to get to. I just, since he mentioned people's history of the United States, I just wanted to mention Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's wonderful work, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, which is, you know, really a complement to, in a sense, the whole people's history movement, but it's something else because it's, you know, from an indigenous eyes view. And anyway, it's really worth checking out. And so just wanted to mention that. And also, just really quickly, you know, we've been talking about, you know, positive developments, the elementary school in Berkeley that banned ethnic-based costumes, Indigenous Peoples Day, but also the Spokane baseball team, formerly known as the Spokane Indians, have been working for about 10 years with the Spokane tribe. I didn't really get to read the article in depth, trying to, you know, establish a working relationship. And, you know, it's not an all-Native team, you know, like the Iroquois lacrosse team is, but they've been doing this, and they actually changed their name, and it's now in the Spokane language, which is really astounding.
Can you say it? That's what I'm hoping, that the announcers will use the
maybe
actual.
Someone will call in who could that
use,
would be great.
We'll use the word in the language instead of using Indians, because I think that when they use very general terms like that, that's what I was when the whole Oregon mascot issue was going on in the schools. I gave testimony and before the Board of Education, and I said, you know, when they're using these very general terms, these include my children, and they only wanted to get input from the 9 tribes of Oregon, and yet most students, Native students, are not members of those tribes. They're like us. They're from somewhere else, and yet all these stereotypes apply to our kids too.
So, do we have another caller? Let's go. Let's go to another caller and just flag this article by David Lewis, the former tribal historian of the Grand Ronde, who's Santiam, Kalapuya, Tacoma, Chinook, and Malala. More local than that, it's hard to get. Anyway, he wrote an article called New University of Oregon Pioneer Uniforms Ignore Oregon Tribes. I don't actually have the source of this, but I'm sure if you put that in your search engine, you can find that. David G. Lewis, just written a few days ago. So let's go to our last caller here. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi. Regarding taking the Indian lands, back in the early 70s, I was watching a protest of Israelis wanting support for stealing Palestinian lands. And the poster said that we'll give back Palestinian lands when America gives back Indian lands.
That's pretty cynical.
Well, you know, that stuck with me for a long time, ever since, for these past 40 years.
So they're saying two rights two wrongs make a right.
My comment is, you know, the wrongs of the past, you know, the consequences for all these wrongs of the past, you know, we're just basically repeating and seeing again today, because, you know, that's pretty much the root cause of all our problems now.
Well,
and so, you know, stealing begets stealing, and if we condone that, then basically, you know, that's again from the wrong path. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, I agree. I think that that's why I'm hoping that when we can have more conversations, and I do think that only by our tribes, acting as being sovereign, can we really garner that respect. I would have to say that the Navajo people did not actually lose a lot of land. We still have all the land within our traditional territory, but what we did lose was a certain amount of say over it, like with the uranium mining. There are a lot of open uranium mines around my family's land, and in that sense, I was lucky not to be raised there next to an open uranium mine. I mean, literally, it's right next to my grandparents' house, we lost a certain control over how our land was being used because of interference from the U.S. government and mining interests. And I think that Americans need to ask themselves, what do they really want? Who are they really? You know, and be the people that they think they are. You know, and part of that is to be honest. And I don't know. I guess if Americans really want to be Indians, then we should have a political way to make them Indians, naturalize them. You know, have them vote with their feet. Join us.
That's,
you know,
it reminds me of can't get into this now, but you know, the story of Thomas Morton, I believe, in Marymount in the colonial United States, where a bunch of, you know, quote, renegade settlers actually went to hang out and with the native people, and they had a tree, I forget what it's called, a maypole tree.
Oh,
and
yeah.
they hacked it down. The story is the colonial leader hacked it down with his sword, and they cut off Thomas Morton's hair.
Uh-huh.
And they sent him back to England anyway as a lesson, because there were defectors.
I think Benjamin Franklin was saying how difficult it was to get Indian children that they had educated to stay. The minute they got, they would leave, no matter how nicely they were treated. But it was the exact opposite. They had a hard time getting colonists to return when they went to. It was much better to live with the Indians, and they didn't want to come back.
I wish we could have started that about half an hour ago, but we are plumb out of time. And so I thank you so much, Jackie. Really appreciate it. And show up tomorrow evening at the First Unitarian Church for this panel that she's going to be on. Thank you, everybody, much. This is Paul Rowland for Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned to KBOO.
Going crazier than hell. Got this time on my hands, and got you on my mind, and got nowhere else to go. The fires burn hot and cold. That's someplace in between the melt and the freeze. This need for reaching for you. You were all I could be. Now I'm here wearing alone. We were one, now I'm a ghost, falling from my place in the sun. It's dizzy.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight at participating Portland area restaurants. Nosh for Nonviolence is a collaborative fundraiser for two local domestic violence intervention agencies.